Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
listen to me. Rich people think differently. So what I'm going to put in your head today is a rich people concept so you can get to understand it. The only difference between successful people and not is just how they think. Rich people think different. Quit letting people tell you you got to get qualified in another program. You don't need another program to be successful. You need to change the way you think. So here's the deal. The problem with becoming a millionaire is that when you decide that you want to be a millionaire, you immediately start thinking, how can I become a millionaire? Well, that thought don't just pop into your head, so you get frustrated and you don't become a millionaire. And you start creating stuff like, well, I guess this wasn't the Lord's will, or as soon as I think of how I'm going to make a million. You can't think of how to make $1 million. Stop. Do you know if you knew how to make $1 million, what's the day, Tuesday? Wouldn't you make it by Friday? Would not you make it by Friday? But suppose I told you how you can become a millionaire with what you have. Because here's the deal. All of you have everything it takes to become rich. You just don't believe it. Now, if you can develop this theory that I'm about to share with you, I have the way for you to be rich. This is it. First of all of you have a gift. God gave it to you when he created you. God never created a single soul without giving them a gift. That's the God that created you. He's a very smart God. Here's the cold thing. When he made you, he put the gift inside of you. He didn't hide it under the ocean. It ain't on the mountain nowhere. It ain't under no rocks. You ain't got to go drilling. God put what you needed inside of you at birth. All of you have a gift. But you have got to do your gift, the thing God gave you at birth to do. It is the thing that you do the absolute best with the least amount of effort. That's your gift. Anything else you're doing, you're wasting your time. Do you hear me? You're wasting your time. If when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it makes you sick every morning that alarm go off, it's because you ain't doing your gift. You're going against what God created you to be. Do most of you know what your gift is? Who in here doesn't know their gift yet? Okay, let me tell you what you do. Go home today. Don't talk to nobody. Sit down and have one conversation with yourself. What is the thing that I do the absolute best with the least amount of effort? This ain't going to take you long. You old enough, you grown. Write it down. I don't care if it's networking. I don't care if it's babysitting. I don't care if it's doing color. I don't care if it's painting. Whatever it is, it's what you do. Sing it. Whatever you do the best, write it down. That's your gift. That's it. You ain't got to go asking a bunch of people. They've been telling you your whole life. You know, you ever have people call you with their problems? They always call you with your problems because you gifted at it. But you didn't know how to identify it. If you identify your gift. Now, let me ask you this question. This thing that you're gifted at, if you did it for somebody, do you think somebody would pay you $10 for your gift? Just $10. Could you babysit for $10? Could you cut somebody's hair for $10? Could you cut their grass for $10? Could you make them a chicken dinner for $10? Could you do something for $10? Everybody, don't you have something somebody would give you $10 for? Yeah. Okay, now, once you have something that somebody's willing to pay you $10 for, this is how this works. It's called the multiples of 10. See, you don't have to figure out how to be a millionaire. You just got to figure out the thing that makes you $10. So now here we go. You do it and you make $10. Soon as they pay you the 10, go do it 10 more times. Whatever it was. Watch some more kids 10 more times. Get another 10. You got $100. When you get $100, whatever you did to make that $100, listen to me, do it 10 more times. You ain't got to get tricky with it. Just do it 10 more times. You'd have made $1,000. Whatever you did to make the $1,000, don't get smart. Stay stupid now. Do it 10 more times. You have now made $10,000. Hold up. Now we finna grow a little bit, but guess what you got to do to grow? You just got to do some more. Whatever you made $10,000 doing, I need you to do it 10 more times. What you tripping for? If you do it 10 more times, you got $100,000. Now, you might have to hire some people to make this happen. You got to figure that part out. But all you got to do is do what you did for $10. Once you make $100,000, if you just do it 10 more times. I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me. And however, he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone, and I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called, and I punched in the code, and he said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth, and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it, I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday, and I can hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sobel from the Comedy Caravan. This is a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back, and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I call Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man, he said, man, I thought I told you, don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I done had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was, they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened.
The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord.
And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I'd never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper. And he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night. And I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because the Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history on Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York. I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
All right, Morning Motivation with Steve Harvey. And this month of February, I think this is the last day of the month, or tomorrow, I don't know. I think this is the last day of the month, 28th. Well, this month of February, Black History Month, has been Slave Entrepreneur Month here on It's My House, and Black Towns History Month as well here on It's My House. And today, we want to feature another, I guess they were, man, well, how can I put this one? They weren't slaves, because most of the people that we featured this month were born slaves. But these people started a township. In any event, we're going to come back. Today's podcast is titled Real Marching and Real Protesting, Charles and Laura Douglas. We're going to talk about marching, real protesting. We're going to talk about do-it-yourself reparations, validation, self-validation, mindset and identity. We're going to also put out there, you know, what's your wealth metric? What are your metrics on determining what wealth is and how to get accumulated? So we'll be back right after this. Thank you. All right, today, last day of the month, and we've been featuring at least one black person in the month of February, commonly known as Black History Month, but around here we call it slave. We focus in on 2 to 3 niches, slave entrepreneurs. That's people that started off legally as slaves, but they became entrepreneurs. Some of them became wealthy entrepreneurs, like Junius George Groves. Started off life as a slave, became an entrepreneur, farmer, and became known as the Potato King while he was alive. Produced more bushels of potatoes than anybody on the planet. Wealthy, became a philanthropist, the whole nine. And other people that got together and practiced group economics, many of them were artisans, people who made things. You know, they made brooms, they made mops, they made ships, they made cabins, they made houses, they made clothes, you name it, they made it. The artisans. And some of them got together, like a group of people, a group of 300 that formed Mississippi in Africa. And they went to Africa and bought at least 2 million acres worth of land, if not 2.5, over 2.5 million acres of land, and started their own communities, many of which still exist today. Like Greenville, Liberia. Well, today we're going to feature two more people as we wrap things up here for February 2022. And this is something I want you guys to change your wealth metric, because a lot of people, we all have different wealth metrics, but the one I'm going to put out here today, I think, is a pretty consistent one. It's ancient, and it's a very good way of measuring wealth. But today's podcast is titled Real Marching, Real Protesting, Charles and Laura Douglas. Well, who was Charles? Who were they? Who was Charles and Laura Douglas? Well, let's start off with Charles. Charles Douglas was the son, one of the sons, at least, one of the children of Frederick Douglass. And Charles Redmond Douglass, and Douglass spelled with a D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S. Charles Douglass and his second wife, Laura, they were turned away from a hotel because of their complexion, their skin tone. And Jesse Jackson wasn't born yet. Al Sharpton wasn't born yet. There was no NAACP yet. Farrakhan wasn't born yet with the Million Man Marches. He was Elijah Muhammad, or the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So what did they do? What did Charles and Laura Douglas do when they were turned away? Did they go hire a lawyer? No, they didn't do that. They didn't sue for their civil rights to stay at somebody else's place that didn't want them in there. What they did was what I call real marching and real protesting. Anything less than what these two did is not real marching, it's not real protesting. When he got turned away instead of getting, well, maybe they did get mad, but they harnessed it. So they did some real marching by marching to whoever was selling land. They could legally buy land. So they marched to whatever real estate office or whatever realtor or whoever was selling off a piece of land, and they found the piece. Now, according to my research, the tract of land that they purchased was either 26 acres or 40 acres. I don't know. Take your pick. Today, I think the place where they could have purchased 26 originally, and then they got up to 40. Then eventually the town today, I think it's 51 acres. But in any event, they purchased by them marching to the place where they can purchase the land, and then their form of protesting, I call real protesting, is they started their own community. They started their own town. That town, which exists today, February 28th, 2022, is called Highland Beach, Maryland. I've been there at least twice. I went there at least twice before I even knew the history of it, okay? I didn't find out the history of it until several years later. In our scrolling marquee, you'll see a picture, and they built two homes. Now, he was part of their protest. To start off now, they bought the 26 or 40 acres, take your pick. They bought that, number one. That's real protesting. That's real protesting. Not just lip service, that's real process. And then they did two other acts of what I call real protesting. Laura and Charles Douglas, her husband, Charles, the son of Frederick Douglas, they built the house for themselves and their children. That's generational wealth, the ancestral house that they built. That's real process. And then they built the house for their for Charles's father or Laura's father-in-law. Those three acts of protest, buying their own land by the acre, to building an ancestral house for them, their household and their family, and then three, building a house for Frederick Douglass, father and father-in-law. That's how Highland Beach, Maryland, which might have a population of about 90 to 100 people today in 2022, a little teeny town, but nonetheless a town. That's how they started off, with real marching to the realtor's office, whoever was selling that land to them, and real protesting by building their own debt-free homes on it. That's what they did. Now, as I've said on here many other times, that reparations can take place and take form in many different ways. And what Laura and Charles Douglas did, I consider that do-it-yourself reparations. Do-it-yourself reparations. They didn't have to wait on the government. They did something which was self-validating. They validated themselves. They didn't need an apology from the hotel that turned them away. They didn't need an apology from the city government where that hotel was. They didn't need an apology from the state of Maryland. They didn't need an apology from the United States government. They did something which was self-validating. And it's the same with reparations. That's why I call it self-reparations. They didn't wait for anybody to say, you're going to get 40 acres in the mule. They went out and bought their own acres of land. Beachfront property at that. I think we can take some lessons from Charles and Laura Douglas. And a part of that is I want you, how are you measuring wealth? Are you measuring wealth by the dollar? What Charles and Laura Nelson did, and many other blacks did it too, is I think the most important source of wealth and the most, and the metric I go by now, is natural resources. When they bought that land, they were buying not only a natural resource, but a tract of land essentially has several natural resources attached to it. In your free time, type in any search engine, natural resources and natural resources distinctions, or the types of natural resources. You know, some of the natural resources, like, let's just take, first thing, let's start with an acre. An acre is 43,560 square feet. That's what an acre is. Get a visual on it. It's about the size of a football field. So they purchased anywhere from 26 to 40 acres of land, eventually 51 acres of land. Now, let's just take a lower number. 26 acres times 43,560 square feet. And then what are the natural resources that are within that 43,560 square feet times 40 or 26, whatever number you pick? That's a lot. I mean, first thing, you know, trees, vegetation, these are natural resources that came with that land. Now, beachfront property, you know, water. And that's surface water on the beach. But under every square foot of land that they had, particularly in that neck of the woods, there's groundwater. Over 43,560 square feet of groundwater. Then when it rains on that land, that's 43,560 square feet per acre of rainwater, that natural resources. Doesn't sound like they were poor people to me. Now, with those natural resources, number one, you've got to recognize the natural resource, and I'm not even going to bring in things like oil into it, or you don't really need to talk about that in this discussion. I value, matter of fact, water is probably more important than oil. But because you don't have water, you're not going to live long. And then even oil contains a high amount of water. But so they were what I call natural resource millionaires, because the metric I'm using is the natural resources when they bought that land. Vegetation, trees, surface water, groundwater, rainwater, and then you can, you know, I don't know what it, if it was heavily wooded, you know, if they can harvest some trees and then sell those, you know, monetize whatever natural resource that they might have had there. But what they did, at least one of the ways, now, this is, I wouldn't call it a natural resource, but one of the ways that they monetized the tract of land that they purchased is, well, the first two things, they built two houses on it. But then later on, they had the land platted out, and then they sold, you know, lots, residential lots, to other family and friends who wanted to live where they live, which is now called today Highland Beach, Maryland. It's a Wikipedia page about them, and I mean, about that place and how they got started, and they have a mayor and all that type of stuff. But that's something that practically anybody can do. You don't need 20 acres. You don't need 40 acres. But, you know, if you get maybe even just a quarter acre and just sit down and look at the natural resources that are in front of you, including yard waste, you know, the leaves on the ground, those could be monetized. Tree branches that fall off trees, that can be monetized. We're talking about natural resources that many people just take for granted. They're walking over money and don't realize it. And well, if you don't know, you don't know. But anyway, so I didn't find a whole lot about, well, there's a little bit written up about Charles Redmond Douglas, son of Frederick Douglass, but that's the highlight I wanted to bring up about him and his second wife, Laura Douglass. They had one child together, but as far as the scope of this podcast for this month, I really like their story and how they, when they were turned away, they did what they could do, and that was buy land and establish. Matter of fact, that was their promised land. And I think a lot of times people get caught up with trying to take part and enjoy somebody else's promised land. And then you get all bent out of shape and offended and hurt when they have lawsuits when somebody doesn't want you on their promised land, but you've got your own. And that's what they did. They went out and they found their own promised land. Now, they had to work it. You know, they had to build houses. They had to probably clear some land. They had to put in the infrastructure. You know, freedom is not free. Freedom costs. So they came out of their pocket. But then they got smart and said, well, you know what, let's plat this out and subdivide it out and sell, you know, sell to some of our family and friends that they want this, they want a safe community where they're the government. They created their own promised land. So the same thing that Charles and Laura Douglas did, you can do the same thing. You know, if you want to get 26 acres or 40 acres, that's, if you want to get 1 acre, if you want to get a half acre, a quarter acre, you know, if you don't feel safe, I don't know, in some of these larger cities, you know, do like they did, man. Find you something and develop. We're going to go to the phone lines in a minute, but we're going to play this Nine Friends. We've played this a gazillion times. Here's my marching orders for this year. Get together with nine friends and do what Charles and Laura Douglas did. Instead of fixing up a house, get nine friends together and buy 40 acres of land.
Say some shit to y'all that I seen yesterday that made me smile, but it hurt me to my heart. There's a house next door to me that's been abandoned, and the yard, the grass, high as hell and everything. There's a couple of abandoned cars out there beside the house. Well, yesterday I get off work about 7 o'clock. A Mexican guy pulled up. He said, "These your cars?" I said, "No." He said, "I just bought this house, man." I said, "All right, that's what's up." He was like, "You know whose cars it is?" He said, "No." He said, "Well, I bought the house, not the cars." Okay, I'm like, cool. I'm thinking he's just coming to look at the house. I go back in the house, do a little straighten up. I swear to God, I walk back at the house. Now, I'm getting off about 7:20. It's fucking 9 Mexican trucks just pull up. They got fucking beer, lights, and shit, right? So I'm like, what y'all finna do? He said, "We finna fix this house." I said, "What kind of crew you got working after 7 o'clock? He said, "These my friends." The fucking house is fixed this morning. They went in there and drywalled that fucking house. I just left out of there. It was a fucking abandoned house. That bitch looked new this morning. Whew. It was an abandoned fucking house. And it looked new this morning. It's an old African proverb. Many hands make light work. I just don't think they're better than us. I just think we won't do nothing together. Wow. You're not hearing what the fuck I'm saying. It was an abandoned house yesterday at 7:15. That bitch is new this morning. He bought a tax lien house. I can't wait to see what they do. I can't wait to see, is one family going to live in there? Is they going to... I'm going to get to know the motherfuckers. You best believe me, when I make some money, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring us together. And I'm not fucking with a lot of people.
All right, well... The strategy that Charles and Laura Douglas did, start their own town, buy some acres of land, and this is, it only, you know, it, two people, that's it, just two people. They were validated within themselves. Once again, they didn't wait on the government. They didn't wait on an apology from any government source. They didn't put up the, well, you know, my because Frederick Douglass started life as a slave. They didn't go, they didn't use the argument, well, my father was a slave or born a slave and his grand, you know, we've been here for 200-300. They didn't, their validation came from their actions. And they just went out and they repaired. They didn't wait for anybody to repair them. See, this is what I call real reparations. Real reparations is when you repair yourself. And the strategy that these two people used, basically anybody can do it. Anybody can do it. They did it with no internet connection, because now we have the powers within our hands through all these electronics we have with smartphones, tablets, laptops, desktops. You don't even have to own any of that today. You can just go to the public library today and use their computers and their internet connection. You can go to your local public library, log on, go to some place like eBay, or a gazillion other sites, and buy land. Real easy. Real easy. So Charles and Laura Douglas, later on they got nine or more friends, but they just started out with just two people. That's all. Two people with no legislation, no acts of Congress, and they exercise, they exercise their civil rights, just like the hotel that turned them away, that was the civil right at the time of that hotel to turn them away. At the time, it was perfectly legal, and it was a civil right policy if they didn't want a certain group of people there or whatever, they had a legal and civil right to do that. But Charles and Laura Douglas, they had a civil right to also go out and buy their own land by the acre, which they did. Just the two of them. That's why I call it real marching and real protesting. Then they exercised the civil right to build a house for their family and a house for Frederick Douglass. The white man couldn't hold them back. White supremacy has a lot of yell today. Couldn't stop them from doing it. And then family, you white supremacist, even that, where is that in this story? And then they decided to incorporate the place and call it Highland Beach, Maryland. Now, they did all this during the Jim Crow era. In 2022, we have people that bow down to the specter, the ghost of white supremacy. I don't get it. If you can help me understand that, 619-768-2945. So I'm looking at, if Charles and Laura Douglas can do this, so can I. And there were hundreds, if not thousands, of other black people, actually thousands, that did the same thing that Charles and Laura Douglas did before they did it. They had 100, 500, 1,000 acres of land. Some formed towns, Some walked away from it due to violence. Some of them kept it and never experienced violence. A lot of that land was not developed. A lot of that land was sold on the cheap. And the reason why I believe a lot of it was sold on the cheap, or a lot of time, or a lot of people walked away from it, from hundreds of acres of land, is because their wealth metric was lacking. A lot of people measure wealth with dollars. And that's it. They don't look at anything else but dollars. But if you got an acre of land, once again, 1 acre equals, well, first thing, land is a natural resource. Much of the clothes that you have on your back, in some kind of way, shape, or form, came from the land. Water, a lot of it came from the land. Most of it, at least. It's a basic wealth resource that, to be honest about it, most people take for granted because it's so abundant, but very essential. So, like I say, my primary wealth metric is not dollars. It's a natural resource. Oh, God, who's calling me? Hold on, people. Wait a minute. Hey, look, let me call you. I'm on a podcast, okay?
Oh, okay. Don't worry about it.
All right, later. All right, that real-time stuff, high school buddy of mine. Anyway, so a piece of land, you know, just it don't have to be an acre, but just take some time and think about it or look at whatever piece of land is around you or available to you. And look at how many resources, natural resources, are within that patch of land. Now, to help stimulate your thought, you might, some of us, because a lot of us have become lazy when it comes to wealth metrics and recognizing wealth, is, you know, once again, go on your computer and type in, you know, types of natural resources or wealth or natural resource distinctions, you know. And then after you look at the different forms of natural resources, you know, then, you know, look at what are the byproducts, what are the byproducts of some of these different types of natural resources? You know, like fertilizer. You know, different types of fertilizer. Topsoil. You know, animals. You know, you could own a piece of land that, you know, deer run through there. Matter of fact, where I'm at, I just know over the weekend. They were probably here the whole time. I just never, you know, saw them or whatever. But, you know, they're wild animals. But, you know, rabbits. You know, so, yeah, to stimulate your mind, you know, look at the different distinctions of the natural resource that you have right there, right where you are. And then type in what are some of the byproducts that can be made from the natural resources that you have wherever you're at right now. And then those byproducts, you know, if you exchange them for dollars or euros or pesos or, you know, what would some of that be worth? But a basic wealth metric for natural resources, I'm going to use the acre or the hectare. Hectares are bigger, like twice the size of an acre, but an acre, 43,560 square feet. For those of you who want to eliminate their electric bill, if you buy you a patch of land as large, the size of a football field, on a nice sunny day, you got 43,560 square acres of sunlight hitting that acre. That's wealth, man. Now, of course, you need the solar panels to harness that light. You can be generating your own power. Because right now, if you're paying if you get an electric bill, you're renting electricity. Whereas on that acre of land that you got, with the 43,560 square feet of sunlight hitting it. What about you people that go out and buy bottled water, Dasani, Fiji, whatever you drink out there as far as bottled water? Think about drilling your own well. Or think about harvesting rainwater, because when that rainwater hits that acre, if you get an inch times 43,560 square feet of rainwater, if you don't harness it, somebody else will. So that's a real basic wealth metric. You know, it's not man-made. You know, like some coming out of the Federal Reserve. It's not coming out of Wall Street. Is natural, essential wealth. Very basic, very fundamental. Personally, I'd rather have give me 100 acres. I'll take 100 acres over $1 million. Because if you give me the right 100 acres, I'll make more, way, way more than $1 million. In any event, read up on, I wasn't able to find any pictures of Laura Douglas. There might be somewhere. I looked, but I wasn't successful in finding any. There might be somewhere floating around online. But we do have in our scrolling marquee a picture of Charles Douglas, Charles Redmond Douglas. But like I say, it's, amen, two people. Two people. They were handed lemons, and they made lemonade to the tune of starting their own, eventually their own town. Okay. Before we go to the phone lines, here we go.
People keep talking about how the world is going to come to an end. And I wonder, in these days and these times, if anybody... Anybody.
You gotta take it.
You gotta take it. People keep talking about how society is falling down today. And as hard as I try not to listen just to what them folks got to say, but you know, I just can't help but look around and see we digging our own grave. And there's just one thing I want to know. Can anybody be saved?
Civil rights District in Birmingham at the entrance of Kelly Ingram Park, where a monument sits to the four girls who were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. That church sits just across the street. It's still an active place of worship today. And if you look to your left, the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, a place where people come from around the world to learn the history and the tolerance it took to change the world. All of this is now part of the National Park Service, but just around the corner from here is the A.G. Gaston Motel, hidden in plain sight. CBS 42's Art Franklin has the story of the place and the man who's a national treasure himself.
I had my high school football banquets in there, and even after I got to be an adult, occasionally came to the lounge.
Birmingham Resource Center Executive Director Bob Dickerson reflecting on days gone by at the A.G. Gaston Motel. Dr. Gaston hired Dickerson to work at his bank, Citizens Federal, in 1984.
I wasn't an important part of his life and his business, but he was such a vital part of man.
It was a time of deep segregation in the South. When Gaston opened the motel in 1954, it was the only place black entertainers and black visitors could stay in Birmingham.
This was the place. I mean, you think about history, world history was made here.
When you look inside of here, you've got to think about the conversations that were held.
Yeah, you got to think about the meetings in there. You got to think about the courage that folks had when they were in these rooms, knowing that that folks, you know, in that day didn't have a problem setting off a few sticks of dynamite.
A pair of bombs exploded here on May 11, 1963, destroying part of the motel. It happened just 2 days after the Big Three, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Fred Shuttlesworth, and Ralph Abernathy, announced a truce with white city leaders and the business community to end a violent showdown between demonstrators and police.
They bombed the motel as they bombed a lot of stuff. But, you know, that didn't stop anything. When you really think about it, now, you know, some people, the four little girls lost their lives and other people lost lives and property, but the movement didn't stop.
The A.J. Gaston Motel was ground zero for civil rights protests and demonstrations. Inside room 30, that was the war room for the movement. It was also Dr. King's headquarters when he was here in Birmingham.
The courageous acts that took place in that room, you know, strategizing on how to fight Bull Connor and fight white supremacy and bigotry and hatred, you know, that all took place right here.
Gaston's role in the movement can't be minimalized. Blacks enjoyed plush amenities at his motel. He provided jobs and changed lives with the A.G. Gaston Boys and Girls Club. Gaston's fingerprints and footprints are throughout Birmingham, especially the Civil Rights District where his bank stood, the Booker T. Washington Insurance Company, and his business college. The motel is crumbling, shattered, and in disrepair, but finally it's slated for renovations as part of the Birmingham Civil Rights National Monument.
I'm really encouraged about what's going to happen. It's sad to see it in disrepair, but it's still standing, and I think we have to take some kind of solace and happiness in that.
All right, A.G. Gaston's, you can, there's at least two books. I've read one of them. I think it's he did. But, and we'll feature him somewhere throughout the year, but, well, we mentioned him today, so he deserves a whole 2 hours to himself. Well, you know, read up on him. There's more information available on him than Charles and Laura Nelson, but the common denominator with A.G. Gaston, and Charles and Laura Douglas is they validated themselves by the actions that they took. And they didn't wait for an apology for ancestors who might have been enslaved or were enslaved. They didn't wait for an apology for that, to do what they did. They didn't need that type of validation. Some people do, but they didn't. And I think we can learn, like I say, read up particularly on A.G. Gaston and read what you can find on Charles Redmond Douglas, that's his full name, Charles Redmond Douglas and his second wife, Laura Douglas, I think her maiden name was Haley, one of the two. But read about the history of Highland Beach, Maryland. There's a lot of good information about A.G. Gaston. Those people validated themselves. Just saying, you can take what you want from it. In any event, I guess that wraps it up for what I call Slave Entrepreneur Month and Black Towns History Month. So what we talked about today with Charles and Laura Nelson, that will go under Black Towns History Month. And, you know, it's interesting when you typically hear about black communities, you hear about Rosewood, you know, that being burnt down, and you hear about Black Wall Street, which was a neighborhood, not a town. You hear about that, the race riot there. But you don't hear about Highland Beach, Maryland, Mount Bayou, Mississippi, Eatonville, Florida, which is 6 miles outside of Disney World, 45 minutes from where I'm at right now. And there are other towns, probably 900 to 1,000 in the United States alone. But a lot of us just focus in on what happened at Black Wall Street and in the John Singleton movie, which took dramatic license. Anyway, that's just my take on it. Um, 314, your mic is now open.
Where's everybody at, Ellie?
It's Monday, and tomorrow's the first, so they might be getting ready for the first of the month. I don't know.
Black Wall Street.
I thought
the
Robin is
home.
It was 40 acres. It wasn't a town. Well, it was Indian or Native American.
All right, that's all I need to know.
But it was a neighborhood on 40 acres. It wasn't what people thought it was.
Yeah, it was still Indian land. It was Native blacks came and helped work on the building the building. But it was Indian land.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's funny, you talk about why come blacks don't take care, they want to have black history, but some of the objects associated with black history, they don't want to take care of it themselves. They want the government to take care of it.
That's true. That's what I don't get. That's why I brought up some of us want to be validated by the government.
Yeah, they want to be part of
the national.
But what's
wrong with validating it yourself?
Yeah, they want to be a national park associated, like Gaston's Hotels. Why come blacks don't take care of that hotel themselves and rejuvenate it?
That's
and
true.
Keep it up? Like Rosa Parks House.
That's true. You're right.
They want white folks to take care of.
Two good examples. Because Rosa Parks
remember
house
the
is
Confederate
somewhere in Europe
daughters?
Right now on display.
You remember the Daughters of the Confederacy?
I'm familiar with that group, as well as the DAR, Daughters of American Revolution. Yeah, I'm familiar. Yeah.
They raise money to build statues and take care of them. And parks.
Mm-hmm.
They take care of, they don't ask the government to take care of them. They take care of them themselves.
Touché. Very good point.
So somebody is lazy and shiftless and forever begging. I got to bring that up to somebody else talking about they want a whole Black History year. Hell, you can't take care of what the heck you got now. Somebody else has got to always come in and help. And if I'm lying, somebody really point out to me where I'm lying.
Well, you, very good point. I mean, not only A.G. Gaskins or Rosa Parks House, which is over the, in Italy right now on display, but at one time, Carter G. Woodson's house was up for auction in D.C. They saved that by raising the tax money. I don't know what's happened to it since. That's like over 20 years ago that happened.
Yeah,
but you're absolutely right, and a very good example. The Daughters of the Confederacy, and I imagine the Daughters of the DAR, Daughters of the Revolution, they right, they take care of their own stuff.
Damn right they do. They ain't begging and asking nobody.
Yeah, we, not, you know what, I can't say we because I don't want to be a part of that we.
I'm not neither. I take care of myself.
But that, and we, well, the money's there to take care of all those things.
Well, you know,
the money's
here's
there
the thing.
To take care of it, but.
Why don't them churches take care of it? And, you know, I like the A.G.
Good point. You know
I
what? You only need a handful. For Rosa Parks, now let's
you know
take Detroit. Detroit easily has 500 Black churches in Detroit, if not double that. And if they just, each one of the church pastors had, and they only collected $1 per church, that could have saved the house. Now, of course, you need more to restore it and all that. But
well, what happened to all
them
big time? What happened to all them big time drug kingpins, Black drug kingpins in Detroit?
You're right, because in Detroit you had the Chambers
Johnny Curry
drug gang. You had the BMF Mafia, which they're running movies about them on TV now. You had drug kingpins. They didn't kick in any money.
You're right. How about the drug boys from down there in North Carolina?
Quite a few that
Frank
ended
Matthews
up in New York.
And all
Frank
them.
Lucas. Yeah, Frank Matthews,
yeah,
Frank Lucas, his brother. All drug kingpins, supposedly earning $1 million a day.
Yes. All they do is talk, complain. They had an identity. They were drug kingpins, right?
That was their identity. They picked it. They were validated by it. They loved the lifestyle and all that went along with it.
Mm-hmm. It's just a shame, man. It's just a shame. And, you know, I really don't care about going back in the history, looking at some individuals that supposedly done things, because you're not accurate on what they done, don't know what they done. You just, it's just a story that's been rehashed and retold. But there's a lot of Black Americans that's doing the American dream, contributing to the well-being of this great nation.
I recommend people read Black Enterprise. You won't get it all there, but you'll get they get a good taste of what's going on currently. And it's online now. I don't think they do the printed version anymore, unless you print it off your own personal printer at home or office. But
and they
there's a lot there, particularly
they also steal people too, because some of the people that's on there, I knew a couple, weren't Native and Black American; they were Jamaicans. And friends of mine was on there also, whose area was in the news when them dumbass activists broke down a gate to enter onto a private street and disturbed the McCloskeys, the white couple who was standing on the front of their property.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
To protect
them. I remember that picture. Yeah, I remember that picture.
Yeah.
But
so they get more history.
We got to do a podcast on that one. Identity. What some people have identified a certain way, and through that identity that they selected, you know, Crips, Bloods, drug dealers, drug kingpins. You know, they've gotten the money one way or another. Then how come they didn't plow that? But how come they didn't buy Rosa Parks' house?
Well,
how come they didn't restore it?
They were dumb and ignorant. They was on the wrong damn street from where they wanted to go. So I doubt very seriously if they could contribute toward that with any substance. They broke as a window pane. All they're good for is making a lot of noise.
Yeah, a lot of those drug dealers live in their grandmother's basement.
Well, those, I don't know what they were. A lot of them activists end up killing each other. They had two or three.
Well, that happens also.
One found burnt up in his car there in O'Fallon Park. Was that? Oh, yes, O'Fallon Park. Another was found burnt up, set on fire. They're alongside a builder there in Ferguson.
Mm.
But they kill each other just like it is in Chicago. They don't, nobody, the thing is, and the police are holding back, taking their time going on calls. Because the thing is,
right,
give them enough time, they kill each other.
Well,
but anyway.
That's what it seems like every day in the news.
Yes. Yeah.
So
anyway, you
had
a nice month.
I'm going
to get out of here.
Yeah.
What you got planned for next month?
All right, then. Don't know yet, but I didn't want the standard Black History Month. Matter of fact, we took a look at the past, so we may as well go into what's happening right now with what people are doing right
now.
You
know, schools don't celebrate that like people think. They may have one or two days of talking about the same old subject, and after that, they don't celebrate that. Yes, another
That's
day.
That's true. Like I say, the same on, the George Washington Carver, Booker T. Washington, Malcolm X, that's why I brought up, something different every day on that. So, yeah, for March, we'll probably do what's happening right now.
I tell you
what
you should study.
On a positive
look at
level.
Look how the Fulani tribes are going in and committing genocide or ethnic cleansing in Nigeria. Killing people, raping women, and recolonizing the area clean down to the Plateau State, one of the 35 or 36 states in Nigeria.
The Fulani, hang up here, I'll get you right. I'll get to work on that right away.
Yeah, that's the same sort of action that led for many blacks that's here, ancestors that's here in the States today, either through wars, burning, looting, theft. Of course, you had those that was unfortunately captured, but a lot of them was gotten rid of because they wasn't of no use and they had caused problems.
Right.
And really, if you were to do the research and go back to those tribes for the individual, you owe them reparations. Because in their society, their debts never satisfied due to the statute of limitation. It goes on and on. Matter of fact, they put curses on the generational curses on the people, spells and hanks, like they used to call it. So anyway, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, I'm going to get to work on this thing right away with the flying.